If you haven't already heard of her, Jessica Townsend is a name to remember. Her debut novel, Nevermore, The Trials of Morrigan Crow, is the first in a magical series that's being hailed as the new Harry Potter. No fewer than 8 major publishing houses were vying for the English language rights to Nevermore at last year's Frankfurt Book Fair. And then 20th Century Fox snapped up the film rights. The book's feisty hero, Morrigan Crow, is a cursed child, battling unseen enemies to fulfill a noble quest beyond her understanding. Like J.K. Rowling, Jessica Townsend creates an enchanted and enchanting world that's full of whimsical inventions, colourful characters, and gripping adventure. She's already attracted legions of fans and embarked on a worldwide publicity tour, but she took time off to join me in the studio. Jess Townsend, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, tell us a little bit more about the world of Nevermore.
So, Nevermore is an imaginary place. It's a place made up. It's sort of inspired by London, inspired a lot by my time in London. And the book Nevermore is about a little girl called Morrigan Crow, who is cursed. So she's born on the wrong day, the unluckiest day, a day called Eventide. And because of this day that she's born, she gets blamed for everything that goes wrong in her world. So there's a little boy who loses a spelling competition and she gets the blame, and someone has a heart attack and she gets the blame, and a school burns down and she gets the blame for that too. So Nevermore, the other side of this curse is that Morrigan also knows when she's going to die. So she's supposed to die on her next birthday, but instead she gets rescued and sort of spirited away into this secret magical city called Nevermore. And she's been invited to stay with this strange person in a magical hotel and compete against hundreds of other children to join the Wondrous Society. And she has to have a talent. So all of these hundreds of kids, they all have some kind of talent or a knack for something that is supposed to get them into the Wondrous Society. But the catch is that Morrigan doesn't have one, and she needs to get into the society if she's going to be allowed to stay.
And the wonderful, rather dandyish figure who rescues her is called Jupiter North, who who reminded me of all those wonderful characters like Bertie Wooster or so on and so forth. But he's just like Bertie Wooster. He, underneath, he's actually a lot smarter than the clothing might make him appear.
Right. I think he comes, and he probably likes coming across as quite silly and not a particularly good adult. I think he is sort of a composite of, you know, all of those characters like Bertie Wooster that I sort of grew up, you know, I grew up watching British television and reading British books, so he's very much influenced by that. But yeah, he is a terrible adult, but in some ways he has his moments. He's quite wise and sort of funny.
And it's a wonderfully fun story. I mean, you clearly have really enjoyed writing it and soaked up, well, I guess, everything you've ever read or experienced. It was about 10 years in the making.
Yeah, it took quite a long time. And I mean, it's that sort of, you know, that side of, you know, really enjoying what I was writing and having fun. Honestly, that's the only reason that I think I finished it, because I'm such a procrastinator, like probably every other writer in the world. And, you know, this is the first book that I've written. It's the first kind of whole story that I've completed, and it did take a long time. But, you know, it's a result of writing the book that I just desperately wanted to read, and every kind of shiny new idea that I had that could have gone on and been a story in its own right, I just sort of thought, well, I'll just put it in Nevermore. It became a bit of a kitchen sink novel in that way.
And I read somewhere that actually Nevermore spun out from another story that you were writing beforehand.
Right. So way, way, way back in the beginning, I started, I'm not even sure if I started sort of writing much of it. I might have written a few pages, but I was plotting a story about a little girl who went to live with her eccentric aunt Morrigan. And her aunt Morrigan was this brave woman who was quite sharp and quite funny and interesting and eccentric. And I started, as I was writing that story, I started realizing that the protagonist, this little girl, was quite boring. And her aunt was the far more interesting. Her aunt and her aunt's best friend, Hawthorne, were the far more interesting people. And I just sort of dialed that back and started thinking about, well, what was she like when she was a little girl? Where did she come from? What happened to her in her childhood that made her so brave and so funny and interesting?
You started writing this, I think I read, when you just finished high school.
Mm.
And whilst you were working at Australia Zoo, were there squeezy crocodiles?
Unlikely, but true, yes. Yeah, so that was my first job straight out of high school. You can clearly hear that I talk funny. I am Australian. I live on from the Sunshine Coast, which is about 20 minutes from Steve Owen's zoo. And it was my first job out of high school. I was working in a shop, folding T-shirts, selling squeezy crocodiles. And I ended up doing a bunch of other different jobs there. I spent about 5 years there. It's the sort of place where if you kind of just muck in and prove that you can, that you're willing to try and willing to work hard, then they'll kind of let you do anything. So weirdly, at the end of that time, I was editing a children's wildlife magazine, which was quite fun.
Well, yeah, and actually it's really refreshing to have an author in the studio who hasn't been through the creative writing courses and isn't painting by numbers, which sometimes it can feel that the creative writing courses teach you to do. And there's a real originality to what you've produced. So you learnt on the job.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, where I'm from, there kind of aren't any, there weren't courses to do. And it was never a thing that occurred to me that that was even sort of a possibility. And I loved writing from a really young age. And I guess the thing that I loved about it then and that I still love about it now is that I don't think of it as a collaborative thing. I'm not part of a critique group. I mean, I can see the value in those. And in some ways, I'm a little bit envious of writers who have those communities because they really seem to thrive in them. But I am such an introvert. And part of the appeal of being an author and writing is that I can sit in a dark room by myself for hours. And I'm quite secretive about my writing as well. Nobody sees anything until I'm absolutely ready.
The move to London, you said earlier, was a bit of a catalyst to the story of Nevermore.
So it was sort of the... I had this character in my head, Morrigan, and when I moved to London was when the city sort of became part of the story. So it was sort of... It was the joining together of placing this character in this magical place. And the thing that I guess Morrigan and I have in common is that she comes to Nevermore and it is this magical city that she has never been to before. And she's just totally blown away by how wonderful it is and how kind of, you know, dangerous and fascinating and how much it immediately feels like it's hers and it belongs to her. And I'm not the first person to feel that when I moved to London, and I will definitely not be the last, but it's a city that kind of, it has that effect on people, and it definitely had that effect on me that, you know, I kind of got here fresh off the boat and thought I had never wanted to live in a city before, but I really felt like London was just the most incredible place and I instantly felt like I belonged here.
You've got a version of the underground called the Wonderground,
right,
in Nevermore. And reading your descriptions of that reminded me of the sort of peculiar enchantment that I first felt when I came up to London and saw this Victorian underground that keeps the city going. It's a lovely feeling.
It's actually wonderful to hear you say that because I feel like I'm screaming into a void when, you know, all my friends from London, they just give me the funniest looks when I talk about how great the underground is. But it is genuinely wonderful. I mean, it transports so many people every day and, you know, all of these lines that crisscross each other under the ground. To me, that's magical because I come from a place where you wait 40 minutes for a bus. So, and I always find it hilarious when you're on the platform and, you know, the little sign comes up that says next, you know, next train 7 minutes, and everyone just groans in frustration. It's like, no, this is a miracle. Like, we're in the future.
And the Hotel Deucalion, where she stays, is, again, a peculiar and enchanted place. You're clearly a cat lover. The enormous human-sized Magnificat who rules the roost is... anyone who's ever had a cat in their house, I think, would recognise those tendencies.
Right. Yeah, well, I used to have quite a grumpy big cat called Hunter. He was the first pet that was my pet, and I had him for many, many years until he sadly passed away. So I think Fenestra is a little bit of an homage to Hunter. I just love giant grumpy cats. Who doesn't? They're adorable. And Fenestra is one of my favourite characters, and she's the character who most often people tell me is their favourite as well. I think she's quite openly sort of snarky and sarcastic, and but she does have this heart of gold, and I have a soft spot for characters who come across as quite sort of abrasive and sort of mean, and then, you know, deep down, you know, they're just marshmallow.
And I know we talked a little bit earlier about the influences that have gone into the book. Were you a fan of the Narnia books, for instance, when you were growing up, or did you just read everything?
I actually never read the Narnia books. I read the first one, and I didn't really carry on with Narnia, but I read quite widely. I read fantasy. I loved reading fantasy, but I read a lot of, you know, grown-up books, and I just sort of read anything that people would put in front of me, and all of my teachers knew that I loved to read, and they'd always bring in books that they were recommending. I loved obviously Roald Dahl, who doesn't? I loved when the Harry Potter books came out. I loved those and grew up with those, really. That's my favourite author growing up was John Marsden, who is an Australian author, which I obviously heard of. And he wrote the series Tomorrow When the War Began. It's just a 7-book series, which is brilliant. And I feel like, you know, my books are kind of wildly different to those, but I do feel like he definitely influenced me as a writer, especially sort of in his sense of humour. And he brought like a really authentic voice to his characters. And, you know, I hope that's something I've picked up from him.
And do the comparisons to the Harry Potter series add pressure to you? I know at the Frankfurt Book Fair, there was a bidding war over which of the publishers was going to represent you and get the English language rights, and obviously the film rights have been sold to 20th Century Fox. Do you feel that puts a pressure on you that you don't particularly like, or are you just very happy to have a full bank balance?
I mean, look, the Frankfurt Book Fair was just slightly ridiculous, and it all happened way, way back in the beginning when I still feel like I have no idea about anything. All of this feels extremely new to me. I mean, I'm thrilled. It's every author's dream to have that kind of response, and, you know, it does sort of thrill and baffle the mind a little bit. I don't feel like there's pressure from my publishers or my agent or my editors. I feel just kind of fully propped up and supported, and everyone is just excited to read what comes next. There is a little bit of, I guess, it's not so much even pressure, it's just sort of unreachable expectations whenever anyone sort of mentions the H word and the P word. you know, I love those books, and I love J.K. Rowling. But we have Harry Potter. I always felt this way, you know, long before any of this happened, when the next book came along that was like, this is the next Harry Potter, this is the next J.K. Rowling. I just kind of thought, but, like, you know, as a fan, as someone who deeply loves these books and this writer, I just think, why do we keep trying to replace them when they still exist in the world? It seems quite silly, but I understand it and I can sympathise with it, because as a big fan, like, you are kind of waiting for the next thing that might make you feel the way that you felt when you first read those books. So I understand the longing for it, sure.
Well, quite a few of us are longing for the second book in the Nevermore series. Without putting any pressure on you, how's it going, and when can we look forward to having it on our shelves?
It's going really well. It's coming up quite close to the completion of it. It's been a really strange beast writing a second book. It's such a, you know, everyone says that, and every time I sort of, you know, spoke to my editor about it, being like, this is kind of weird and it's so different, she would literally just pull out her phone and Google second book syndrome and like scroll through all the results at me. So, you know, I'm not the first person to sort of feel the strangeness of it, because as everyone says, you know, you've got a lifetime to write your first book and then 6 months to write your second one. Luckily for me, I am such a plotter, I'm such a planner, and such a daydreamer as well. And I have so much of this series already plotted out and in my head, and I kind of have a very good blueprint. So I definitely wasn't going in blind. But yeah, we should be seeing that in autumn this year. And I have enjoyed it. I have enjoyed aspects of it. And aspects of it have been slightly frustrating, but it's all a big learning curve.
Have you settled on a title yet?
Mm. Yes, would you like to know what it is?
If you're prepared to share.
I am. I wonder if I'm allowed to share the whole thing. I haven't actually asked anyone. Yeah,
I'll just do it.
Tell
me, and then you can ask Dominic afterwards.
Okay, cool. Alright, yeah, sure. So the name of book two is Wondersmith, The Calling of Morrigan Crow.
Well, you heard it here first. And how many books do you think there will be in the series?
Well, I'm planning for 9. I've always planned it as a 9-book series. There will definitely be 3, so I have a 3-book deal. I hope that there will be 9. It's looking good at the moment. There are good signs that I'll be able to sort of write the whole series, which is fun.
Well, that should give me Christmas presents for the next few years then.
Yeah, job's a good one.
Did you have anything to do with the choice of narrator for the audiobook? Because it's beautifully read by Gemma Whelan.
Isn't it? It's one of my favourite things that has happened in this whole process. Like, it's been a year and a half of just crazy thing after crazy thing. But when I first heard Gemma Whelan reading the audiobook, it's like my brain exploded. They sort of presented it to me as, you know, this is the person that we're thinking of. I was stoked. And when she said yes, I was just so pleased. She is so talented. And I listen to quite a lot of audiobooks because I have this thing in the last year or so where every time I pick up a physical book to read it, I just feel quite guilty that I'm not sitting down working on my own book. But audiobooks, they're a different matter. You can listen to them on public transport and when you're doing your makeup and when you're cooking and so on. So I've been listening to a lot of them, and I know that I have a bias because she's reading my book. But I genuinely think that this is one of the best audiobooks that I've ever heard, purely down to her talent. You know, she's so, just all of the different voices. And I didn't even realize until I listened to it how many speaking parts there are in this book. And she comes up with this voice and this character for every single one of them. And anytime anyone brings up the audiobook to me, they immediately regret it because I will just gush endlessly about how wonderful I think it is.
I can recommend several excellent child psychologists in the greater Jacalfax area. The new caseworker hadn't touched her tea and biscuits. She'd travelled 2.5 hours from the capital by rail that morning and walked from the train station to Crow Manor in a wretched drizzle. Her wet hair was plastered to her head, her coat soaked through. Morrigan was struggling to think of a better remedy for this misery than tea and biscuits, but the woman didn't seem interested.
"I didn't make the tea," said Morrigan, "if that's what you're worried about."
The woman ignored her. "Dr. Fielding is famous for his work with cursed children. I'm sure you've heard of him. Dr. Llewellyn is also highly regarded, if you like a gentler, more maternal approach." Morrigan's father cleared his throat uncomfortably.
"That won't be necessary."
What I think is so wonderful about her is that she gets all the characters. The villains and the heroes are usually any narrator concentrates on, but even the little bit part characters who pop up, you immediately recognise that voice from, I don't know, 50 pages beforehand. And she's got your villains down to a T as well.
Though. She does, yes. My favourite voice actually is, I don't want to give any spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book, but my favourite voice is actually Mr. Jones. The fact that she made Mr. Jones Welsh. it makes sense, I suppose, but I hadn't anticipated it, and I just love it so much. And you're right, every little voice, every small character is so distinct, and she's put so much thought into it. The whole thing is so thoughtful. She's really read the book and thought about how these people should sound, and I just love her.
And you must be delighted that actually through audiobooks you're getting to a whole audience who couldn't read the physical print copies.
I am. I think that's just amazing that it can kind of be shared with this whole, you know, group who wouldn't otherwise. I think, it surprises me that every book isn't an audiobook. I'm not sure what kind of sort of percentage of books actually get made into audiobooks, but I am thrilled and just delighted, and I feel extremely fortunate that Nevermore has been made into an audiobook for exactly that reason.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed that Gemma is going to do books 2, 3, 4.
Oh, absolutely. I'm holding on to her. She doesn't even know it.
You're obviously doing a world tour at the moment as well, which is quite exciting. Are you going around the rest of the UK?
I've got this week we're doing, because the paperback is just coming out this week. So this week we're doing some school events. I started yesterday with some schools up north, which was lovely. Lots of cute little faces. And then next week we'll be doing some bookstores. I'm sort of living part-time in the UK and part-time in Australia at the moment. So I'm here for a few more months and we'll be doing various events. And we did all, you know, at the end of last year when the hardback came out, we already did sort of Australia, New Zealand and the United States. So now we're going to focus on the UK, which will be delightful because I love going everywhere by train.
And you can write on the train.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Jess Townsend, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I hope you come back when book two in the Nevermore series is published.
Thank you so much. I would love to. Thanks for having me.
Corvus had developed a subtle twitch in his left eye that only appeared during these mandatory monthly meetings, which signalled to Morrigan that he hated them as much as she did. Coal black hair and crooked noses aside, it was the only thing father and daughter had in common. "Morrigan has no need of counsel," he continued. "She's a sensible enough child. She is well acquainted with her situation."
The caseworker chanced a fleeting look at Morrigan, who was sitting beside her on the sofa and trying not to fidget. These visits always dragged. "Chancellor, without wishing to be indelicate, our time is short. Experts all agree we're entering the final year of this age, the final year before Eventide." Morrigan looked away, out the window, casting around for a distraction, as she always did when someone mentioned the E word. "You must realise this is an important transitional period for..."
"Have you the list?" Corvus said, with a hint of impatience. He looked pointedly at the clock on his office wall.
Of course.
Gemma Whelan narrating The Trials of Morrigan Crowe, the first book in the Nevermore series, written by my guest Jessica Townsend. Thanks to Jessica Townsend. The Trials of Morrigan Crowe is available commercially in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. And Jess will be back at the end of the show to reveal the books of her life.